Today, home prices versus gravity. Gravity wins. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest edition of the Property Imperative Weekly to the 2nd of June 2018. Our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The average home value fell in May 0.1% and took the annual change down 0.4% and into negative territory for the first time since October 2012, according to the latest CoreLogic Index. May marked the 8th consecutive month-on-month fall since the national market peaked in September last year, taking the cumulative fall in dwelling values to 1.1% through to the end of May 2018. This was caused by weaker conditions in Sydney and Melbourne, although some regional centres did move higher. But the sheer weight of numbers means that the overall index is hit when Sydney and Melbourne both fall, as around 6% of properties are in these two centres. The root cause of the fall is simple. Credit is harder to get. Our surveys show that up to 40% of applications for mortgages are now being turned down, compared with just 5% a year ago, as lenders apply more forensic analysis of applications received. For example, as we discussed yesterday, CBA is now looking at applications with a loan-to-income ratio of 4.5 times and above. See our post, A Deeper Dive into Loan-Income Ratios. And I'm getting more reports of households who are finding their available borrowing power is as much as 35% down on a year ago. So unlike the small correction which occurred to the CoreLogic Index in 2015 as credit was harder to get briefly and which reverted a few months later, we think it's different this time. As we discussed in our post, What's Happening to Bank Lending, the RBA released their credit aggregates to April 2018, and total mortgage lending rose $7.2 billion to $1.76 trillion, another record. But within that, owner-occupied loans rose $6.4 billion, up 0.55%, and investment loans rose just 0.14%, up $800 million. Personal credit fell 0.3%, and business lending rose $6.3 billion, up 0.69%. The annualized stats shows owner-occupied lending is still running at around 8%, whilst business lending is around 4%, investment lending is down 2.3%, and personal credit is down 0.3%. On this basis, household debt is still rising, but the bank lending data from APRA showed that tighter lending standards are biting. In fact, Westpac apart, all the majors reduced their investor property lending in April. Owner-occupied loans grew by 0.29% or $3.1 billion to $1.07 trillion, while investment loans fell slightly, down 0.01% or $42 million. So as a result, the relative share of investment loans fell to 34.14%. Melbourne has taken over from Sydney as the weakest performing housing market over the past 3 months, with a 0.5% fall in values over the month of May to be 1.2% lower over the previous 3 months. This is the largest decline in Melbourne dwelling values over a three-month period since February 2012. We expected this as Melbourne's housing market was running ahead of Sydney, but recently auction clearance rates have been significantly lower. Also, inventory levels are rising and transaction activity is tracking 12.9% lower than a year ago. In Sydney, home prices showed a month-on-month fall down 0.2%. Perth was down 0.1%, Darwin down 0.2%, and Canberra down 0.1%. Sydney was the only capital city other than Melbourne to record a decline in dwelling values over the past 3 months, with a 0.9% fall. Hobart's impressive run of capital gains continued and is showing little signs of slowing down, with dwelling values jumping 0.8% over the month to be 3.7% higher over the rolling quarter and 12.7% higher year on year. But of course, it's a small market. Again, we are seeing the strongest falls at the top end of the market, as we discussed last week. In Sydney, the most expensive quarter of the market has seen dwelling values fall by 7.1% since peaking, compared with a 1.4% fall across the least expensive quarter of the market and a 3.3% decline across the broader middle of the market. Similarly, in Melbourne, the most expensive quarter of the market is down 3.3% since peaking, while the broader middle market saw dwelling values fall by 0.8%, whilst the most affordable quarter of properties did not decline at all, remaining at record high values. Because of the price differential, units are performing a little better than houses. It's also worth looking in more detail at the regional areas, as we see significant variations there. CoreLogic says that across the regional markets, Geelong retained its position as the best performing area outside of the capital cities, with dwelling values up 10.2% over the past 12 months. The top 10 performing regional markets are a mix of satellite cities such as Geelong, Ballarat and Newcastle, as well as lifestyle markets such as the Sunshine Coast, the Southern Highlands, Shoalhaven and Coffs Harbour. Regional housing trends are also now seeing less drag from the mining regions, although the weakest performing areas are generally still linked to the mining and resource sector. The declining trend has eased or even levelled across many of these markets. Mackay in Queensland was the worst performing area, down 10.6% year on year. Credit availability apart, demand for property is falling, with investors still coy about buying and some in fact looking to sell before prices fall further. And the latest data from the Foreign Investment Review Board shows that the number of foreign buyers have fallen. Whereas in the year 2015-16 saw 40,149 approvals granted, totaling $72.4 billion, the figure for the following year was just 13,198 approvals, totaling $25.2 billion. On these numbers, the foreign property investment boom looks to be over. And by the way, the data is only reported at a very high level, and so we do not have much insight below the top line numbers from the FIRB. This needs to be addressed. All this is reflected in the weaker auction clearance results. CoreLogic reported that the overall final auction clearance rate fell to 56.2% last week. That's the third consecutive week where the weighted average has progressively declined. There were 2,297 homes taken to the market, which was only slightly higher than the week prior, when 56.8% cleared. The last time clearance rates were tracking at a similar level was in early 2013, though then volumes were down thanks to the January lull. In Melbourne, the final clearance rate dropped below 60%, with 59% of auctions successful, which is down on the 62% the previous week. In Sydney, both auction volumes and the final clearance rate increased a little last week, with 814 auctions and a final clearance rate of 56.1%, which is higher than the 54% the previous week. Adelaide, Canberra and Perth all saw a week-on-week improvement in clearance rates, while Brisbane and Tasmania's clearance rates both fell. And across the non-capital city regions, the highest clearance rate was recorded across the Hunter region, with 72.4% of 54 auctions successful. CoreLogic is tracking 2,121 auctions this week, down slightly from last week. And weekly volumes are remaining relatively steady over the past 3 months, while the weighted average clearance rate has continued to weaken. Over the same period 1 year ago, there was a considerably higher 2,578 auctions held. So have no doubt, prices have further to fall. Gravity is winning in markets where, on a fundamental basis, property is still overvalued by around 40%. The lift in the minimum wage by 3.5% for more than 2 million Australians, which was announced this week, will lift wages to $719.28 a week, and a rise of $24.30 for a 30-hour week. Trade unions wanted an increase of $50 a week, arguing it would help Australians grappling with the rising costs of living. The increase may add up to 0.5% to the wage price index, which has been bumping along at or near historic lows of around 2% for the last 3 years. But as 80% or so of workers are not on the minimum wage, we are not sure that this will have any visible impact on home price moves. The big banks had a further terrible week as the ACCC confirmed that criminal cartel charges are expected to be placed by the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions against ANZ, Deutsche Bank and Citigroup, as it's alleged the joint lead managers took up approximately 25.5 million shares of an ANZ share placement in 2015. This represented approximately 0.91% of total shares on issue at the time. This is a criminal case rather than civil and carries potentially much higher fines, up to 10% of turnover, as well as imprisonment. ANZ's share price was down significantly, despite still being the darling among the big four for many analysts. The ACCC also warned more cartel cases are in the works. Separately, CBA said that an investigation was initiated after a concern raised about internal CBA emails being inadvertently sent to email addresses using the CBA.com domain prior to April 2017, when the bank acquired ownership of the CBA.com domain. CBA's email domain is cba.com.au. CBA's acting group executive of retail banking services, Angus Sullivan, said, "We want our customers to know that we are committed to being more transparent about data security and privacy matters. Our investigation confirmed that no customer data has been compromised as a result of this issue. We acknowledge, however, that customers want to be informed about data security and privacy issues, and we have begun contacting affected customers." CBA's share price was down to a five-year low in reaction to the battery of bad news in recent times, as well as weaker home loan trends. And at the Royal Commission, more poor bank behaviour was revealed in the handling of small business customers, thanks to errors and more deliberate intent. As we discussed in our post, The Problem with Small Business Lending, banks make a risk assessment of a business from the perspective of loss of a loan as a prudent banker, not the overall business performance.
One way of understanding the standard that is imposed by the Code of Banking Practice might be that the bank ought to act to satisfy itself to a reasonable standard that the borrower will be able to repay the credit facility. That is to say, the prudent and diligent banker is acting in order to protect the bank. The bank is not warranting the success of the borrower's business, nor is the bank acting as an advisor to the business borrower, and nor can it be expected to be. In each of the three cases, the borrower was relying upon some third party for advice and assistance. In one case, the third parties were an accountant and a franchisor. In another case, the third parties were a broker and the franchisor. And in a third case, the third parties were an accountant and a lawyer. Those are the people to whom the borrower can turn and ought to turn for advice and assistance in decision making. Now, we acknowledge that in many cases, this very legal way of looking at things and the relationships between the borrower and third parties and the borrower and the bank might be undermined by the nature of the relationship that banks want to encourage with their customers, being one of trust and partnership, evidenced by slogans promising that we're here to help, or support your business every step of the way, or it's possible to love a bank. But slogans are not legal obligations, though they no doubt contribute to the expectations of the community as to the role and nature of the bank and its relationship with the customer. In all three of the cases, the business has failed not because of some issue reflective of a very technical flaw in the loan assessment, such as the interest rate rising outside of a particular buffer that had been used in the calculation of serviceability, but rather the business failed because fundamentally the performance of the business did not live up to the projections that were presented to the bank and the hopes and the aspirations of the borrower. Small business entrepreneurs are, by their nature, optimistic about the ability of their business to succeed. Any increase in regulatory requirements on banks to scrutinise the optimism of a small business borrower must necessarily be premised on the proposition that the banks are too willing to make loans to small business. Neither the case studies nor the work that we have done outside of the hearings suggests that this is the case.
The Commission is not recommending that any additional statutory obligations be placed for small business lending. But the banks and ASIC have issues to answer, as outlined in the closing statements. I felt ASIC's approach to regulation was shown up pretty poorly. The Royal Commission also announced that the new hearings will commence on Monday the 25th of June in Brisbane and end on Friday the 6th of July in Darwin. Misconduct in regional financial services is one of the key issues that first ignited calls for a Royal Commission by advocates like National Senator John Williams. Turning to the broader financial market scene, the volatility index, the VIX, is still sitting around 13, somewhat elevated compared with a few months ago, but well off its highs. But markets were rocked by the return of tariff tantrums and geopolitical uncertainty in the Eurozone before shifting to US domestic issues as a bullish jobs report helped steady risk appetite. The US unemployment rate fell again, though wages remained pretty flat. Private payrolls grew by 223,000 for May, a sharp uptick from 163,000 in April, which beat economists' forecast of 189,000. That provided the impetus for US stocks to recoup some of their losses, which followed fears of a global trade war. US tariffs on steel and aluminium imports from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union were triggered, drawing retaliatory measures from all three of the United States' allies. US markets were also disturbed by Italian political turmoil, which has since abated after Giuseppe Conte was sworn in as Italy's new prime minister. The S&P 500 closed roughly flat for the week. Crude oil prices added to their 5% losses last week with a 3% slump this week, following an expansion in US oil output and uncertainty on whether OPEC and its allies would ease limits on production. As the OPEC meeting, slated for June 22nd, draws closer, traders remained wary of the oil cartel easing production limits, despite a Reuters report midweek citing a Gulf source that OPEC and its allies would stick to production curbs, which have helped slash the glut in global supplies. Fears that limits on the production cut agreed could be eased overshadowed a weekly Energy Information Administration report showing US crude supplies unexpectedly fell by 3.6 million barrels in the week ended May the 25th. Crude futures settled 1.8% lower on Friday as data showed US oil rigs increased, pointing to signs of growing domestic output. The US dollar scraped its third straight weekly win after a strong jobs report on Friday helped the greenback recover some of its early week losses, paving the way for the Federal Reserve to hike rates in June and helping the greenback steady against its rivals. The greenback suffered heavy losses on Wednesday after uncertainties in Italy, but the last-ditch talks by Italy's five-star movement and League were successful as Giuseppe Conte was sworn in as Italy's new prime minister on Friday. The dollar rose 0.24% to 94.18 against a basket of major currencies on Friday. Gold prices were unable to add to their gains from last week, posting a weekly loss as the prospect of the further Fed rate hikes in the wake of the upbeat jobs report reduced demand. Analysts warned, however, that a single jobs report, albeit solid, was not necessarily enough to warrant a faster pace of rate hikes. Average hourly earnings at 2.7% year-on-year is within the range it has trended since mid-2016 and not enough to warrant a faster pace of rate hikes, one analyst said. Upward pressure on funding will come from higher US rates if the Fed does move in June as expected. The US 10-year Treasury bond rose 0.25% on Friday and is off its recent lows on the expectation of rate hikes ahead. Bitcoin saw lower lows this week, but its test of $7,000 was met with a wave of buying, stoking hopes of a recovery in the popular crypto. Some analysts said earlier this week that the $7,000 region triggered some very key support for Bitcoin, opening the door to a possible recovery, yet traders continued to adopt a cautious approach. The total crypto market capitalization was roughly unchanged from a week ago, at $329 billion US dollars. Over the past 7 days, Bitcoin fell 0.09% on the Bitfinex exchange, Ethereum fell 2.69% while Ripple XRP rose 0.79% on the Poloniex exchange. So overall, we think the home price data will continue to deteriorate further against a backcloth of international financial uncertainty. And finally, in his opening statement to the Senate Economics Legislation Committee, Wayne Byres, APRA chairman, said that Australians can be reassured that the finance industry is financially sound and that the financial system is stable. So that's okay then. Just before I sign off, I wanted to highlight our planned live question and answer session, which is scheduled for next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney local time. This will be streamed via YouTube, and I plan to take questions live via the built-in YouTube chat, as well as answering questions which I have received from earlier posts and conversations. The session will be posted as a normal post afterwards, so you can choose to send questions through over the next few days. Join me live at 8 p.m. Tuesday, or watch the sessions afterwards. I hope to see you there, and remember to mark your diary. I have put up a scheduled event on YouTube. If you like what you heard here today, please like the post and add a comment or question. If you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.